welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Steve Kim. I hope you all are enjoying the summer. Maybe with the exception of those of you who might be listening in from the Southern Hemisphere. I know in the past we've had listeners from Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and even Brazil. I don't know if that's still the case, but it was kind of cool to see that at the time. Where I am, near Edmonton, it's been pretty hot, but things are already cooling down substantially. I woke up this morning to find the thermometer reading 8 degrees. I thought to myself, what in the name of all that is holy is going on in July? I've only been in this area for 3 months or so, so I don't know what's typical in terms of weather for this area yet. But as my wife tells me, and she's originally from this area, sometimes the weather cools down pretty significantly by mid-August. Maybe that's happening already. I guess I'll see how I cope with 7 months of the Canadian prairies winter. I'll probably feel a lot more Canadian on the other end of it. Whether I'll actually get through it is another question. Speaking of summer, though, Andy, Terry, and myself have been taking the much-needed breaks. When we do that, though, we don't want to leave our listeners hanging, so we are bringing you some of the sessions from our past conferences. Last week, we heard from Natasha Crane on apologetics for parents. This week, we bring to you the breakout session from Dr. Paul Chamberlain, entitled Right for You, But Not for Me, Responding to Moral Relativism. He teaches in the area of Christian apologetics, ethics, and philosophy of religion at Trinity Western University in Langley, British Columbia. And he is also the director of Trinity's Institute of Christian Apologetics. I think I said it right. He's a good friend of the ministry at Apologetics Canada, and he has been a regular speaker at our conferences. If you like what you hear and you want more, you can go to our web store at apologeticscanada.com/store, and you'll be able to purchase the recordings from our past conferences. So, at this point, let me get out of the way and have Dr. Chamberlain take over. Enjoy.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. Nice to see you all here. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
You can't? I don't have much of a voice. This is my first assignment back after being laid up cold for the flu this week. So I'm actually feeling not too badly. I just want to have a whole lot of strength. I don't know if I can project. Can you hear me okay back there? Oh, boy. Okay, so we're going to do the best we can, and if you can't hear, just do that, or somehow let me know, and maybe somebody else can shoot it back to you. Maybe we'll try it that way. Okay. Well, listen, my name is Paul Chamberlain, and I teach at Trinity Western University. I've been there teaching here since 1990. Can you believe it? Some of you weren't even alive when I got my job in 1990. Probably weren't even thought of in 1990. Okay. It's amazing. But it's been a really good position. I remember getting it. I was really thrilled to get it. I'm still happy to be there, still thankful for it. I got a job teaching in the Department of Philosophy when I first got the position, because that's what my degree is in. I came up from Milwaukee, although I grew up in Alberta, but I got the degree in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, got the job at Trinity. But apologetics always meant a lot to me. And it wasn't very long, within a year or two, that I was teaching the university's apologetics course as well. And I remember about 1996 or 7, 8, somewhere in there, the president at the time, Dr. Neil Snyder, anybody know that name? President for a long time at the university. He and I would go for lunch together about once a year. And he took me out for lunch one day and said, Paul, we need to start an institute for Christian apologetics. And you need to direct it. At the time, I was a little bit nervous about the idea of directing, because I had seen what it's like to start academic programs and the vision statements you have to put together and the purpose statements and the courses you're working out. And I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. I wasn't sure I wanted to learn all that. I just thought there was a lot of headaches. So I wasn't sure. Then I went to work with Ravi for a little while. And when I was out with Ravi, I would have these different people come to me, usually young people, and say, well, I want to study apologetics. Where do I go to study apologetics in Canada? And I began thinking, wow, you got a course, there's a course here, they got a course. Well, where do you go to get in-depth study in apologetics in Canada? And so I talked to Ravi. I said, well, I can only think of two. I can think of Biola in Southern California, and over in South Carolina, they've got one as well. Is that it? And Ravi said, yeah, just those two that I know about. And I said, well, that's not in Canada, And so I thought back to what Neil had said, Neil Snyder, and I came back and I said, are you still interested in doing that? And he was. So we sat down with the people at Acts Seminaries in 2000 and we established it. And it's been a really exciting thing. And I feel like I got about the best job in the West Coast because I love to teach and I love apologetics. And I think it's so necessary today. And the issues we're working on today is an interesting one because it sounds like it's ethics, but it's actually apologetics. It's actually ethics and apologetics all at the same time. And you can cover it in both kinds of courses if you want to, depending how you want to do it. The courses, the issue is, of course, moral relativism. Right for you, wrong for me. There's different ways people talk about these things. But we're going to get into it right now with that, with this issue. And I guess I'd like to start by reading a couple of little articles I got, and you tell me what you think. What you think about these articles here? This one is written by a retired not principal, but retired superintendent of schools, in southern BC. Let's put it that way. Just a short time ago, and he writes this. It's in the newspaper. It says, each night as our family watches the evening news, I sense a tide of moral ambiguity flooding across my 16-year-old son's intelligence, sweeping the last vestiges of his innocence before it. He has questions about wars, about violence, about disease, about politics, and the media's take on it all. No, I'm skipping a whole bunch of this, but he says he's asking because such things trouble him as he tries to develop his own ethical and moral fix on life and how he should navigate himself in this information-rich sea of contradictions. We talk about that and how to decide what feels right and what does not, as if there is some conscientious compass built into every human spirit, which, if trusted, will point to somewhere between ethical behavior and free will. But it's not enough, I know. He'll need some way when the time comes, and it will likely come when I'm not around, to resolve his own dilemmas and guide his own behavioral choices. He says, most kids... most kids want to learn how to face issues. Some never do, and the quality of their lives is proscribed accordingly. He says, but many kids are left with the major questions unanswered. Is there such a thing as right and wrong? Can both sides of an issue be right or wrong? How do you distinguish? To find out, in the absence of any other properly structured experience, they turn back to the classroom of last resort and ethical ambiguity and just watch television. Okay, so at the bottom I wrote my own little editorial, good luck, is what I wrote on the bottom, okay, good luck with that. Well, he is actually getting at an issue, isn't he? He's getting at the challenge that the people face, young people face, living in today's world. And I want to talk a little bit about what it must be like, what it's like to be a young person in the culture that we're in, living as we do. Let me read you another article. This is from a Christian philosopher living in teaching in the United States. And she writes this. Some time ago, I published an article entitled Ethics Without Virtue, in which I criticized the way ethics is being taught in American colleges. I pointed out that students taking college ethics classes debate abortion, euthanasia, capital punishment, DNA research, and the ethics of transplant surgery, while they learn almost nothing about private decency, honesty, personal responsibility, or honor. I argued that the current style of teaching ethics, which concentrates so much on social policy, is giving students the wrong ideas about ethics. Social morality is only half of the moral life. The other half is private morality. I urged that we attend to both. A colleague of mine did not like what I said. She told me that in her classroom, she would continue to focus on issues of social injustice, women's oppression, corruption in big business, transgressions of multinational corporations in third world countries. She explained it this way. You are not going to have moral people until you have moral institutions. You will not have moral citizens until you have a moral government. She made it clear that I was wasting time and even doing harm by promoting bourgeois virtues and not awakening the social conscience of my students. At the end of the semester, she came into my office carrying a stack of exams and looking very upset. Anybody seen a prof do that before? Not just because they have to grade them, okay? And she said, what's wrong, I asked. They cheated on their social justice take-home finals, she said. They plagiarized. More than half of the students in her ethics class had copied long passages from the literature. "Well, what are you going to do?" I asked. She gave me a self-mocking smile and said, "I'd like to borrow a copy of that article you wrote on ethics without virtue." And she goes on to say, "Cheating has plagued many of our best universities. A recent survey reported in the Boston Globe says 50% of all college students admit to cheating. For high school students, the figure is 75%. A U.S. News and World Report survey asked college age students if they would steal from an employer. 34% said they would. Many people," she says, concluding the part I'm going to read, "many people come to college," and notice what I'm saying, it's not that college does this to them, they come to college already, "dogmatically committed to a moral relativism that offers them no grounds to think that cheating is simply wrong." And I think that's exactly right. They, when they come to the university or to college, they come that way. What are your thoughts when you hear that? Anything come to your mind when you hear that kind of these kind of articles?
It's sad.
Sad.
Yeah.
It's
backwards.
It's backwards. It's eternal. Yeah.
Yeah, I just think that it just emphasizes how important it is that we teach our kids that there is a right and
no, that we have some clarity on these matters. Yes. If we're going to teach them, we're going to have clarity, aren't we? We're going to have to be super clear on these things ourselves, crystal clear. Otherwise, we're going to have trouble teaching anything at all if we don't have a real crystal clear idea ourselves. That is exactly my goal in this session right here. Let's get clear on this so we can teach it ourselves, because maybe we can have a hand in helping young people sort their way through some moral confusion in our culture and giving them some clarity. I think there's some encouraging signs in the midst of it as well. But that's exactly right. And anybody else? Is there another comment? Okay.
What? I'm sure parents want their kids to be honest and hardworking.
Yeah, yeah.
But why do we have a generation that has no sense of...
Where did this all come from? You know what is really interesting about that, Dan? This same person, Dr. Christina Hoff Sommer, has written elsewhere. She wrote this, I'd say, 10, 15 years ago now. She said, "We are now living in the first generation in the history of the human race, as far as she knows, that is finding it unable to pass along its moral values to its young." And why? Because moral relativism undercuts them. Okay, so you try to pass on your moral values, but you can't do it because moral relativism undercuts them. That's a stunning statement, whether she's right about it being the first or not, but it really is a stunning statement. Let me say one more thing before I get into the material I've got here, and I want to give you a handout. I'll pass out some of these, and we'll see how we go. I'm going to ask you if you wouldn't mind. I was going to ask you to leave these for the next session, but I'm going to just give some of these and ask you if you can share with these. C.S. Lewis has made the statement that Christianity's greatest enemy... I wonder if you could guess what it is. Well, we're talking about it here today. He said the greatest enemy of Christianity, C.S. Lewis said. Think about this now. Very, very strong statement. When you say the greatest, E-S-T, that's the superlative. That means there's only one that fits this category. The greatest enemy of Christianity, moral relativism. And I guess my question for you is, before I pass these out to you, why would he say a thing like that? Why would he or anybody make a statement like that? In what sense could you think of moral relativism as being the greatest enemy of Christianity? Anybody want to tell me?
There's no need for a savior.
That's exactly right. Can you explain that? Add that a little bit to that?
Sure. If everyone's own viewpoint is correct,
yeah,
or right,
yeah,
then there is no sin.
Okay.
If there's no sin, we don't need to be saved from anything.
Okay. See, if there is no such thing as real objective moral truth out there, mm-hmm. It's just your preference versus my preference. Morality is a purely subjective and relative thing. Then nobody has really, there is no objective moral standard that anybody could possibly violate. Nobody has violated it. And if you haven't violated that moral law, then you do not stand in need of forgiveness, of grace, of a savior, and Christianity cannot even get off the ground. Because C.S. Lewis is the guy who said, there's two things that everybody has to agree to first before Christianity has anything to say to them. And and some of you don't probably know what those are. The first one is that there is a moral law up there. And number two, we have violated it, and we will continue to violate it. If there's a moral law there, a real one, and we violated it, then we may stand in the need of forgiveness and of a Savior. Because once you admit that, Christianity steps in and says, yes, and we have a message for you about a God who became man, Jesus. He died on the cross to forgive the sins that you've committed. But if you haven't committed any sin, there's nothing to be forgiven. And that's why he says moral relativism is the one thing that has to be dealt with and has to be responded to just as decisively as anything ever could. Now, I only have a few of these handouts. I'm wondering if you're able to take, anybody can just take one if you can share with people around you, or if you think you're okay with that one, just pass them on by. I don't have nearly as many as people in the room. So if we're able to do something like that, that would be good. Okay. But we're going to walk through, it's just got a few of the definitions and things we're working with. So it's not even critical anyway, but I thought I'd put it together for us to help. Listen. Having said what we've said about moral relativism, the first thing we have to do is define our term. Define a term here. So let's get the definition of moral relativism on the table here, and it's on the handout there, and or you can just jot this down if you need to. But it's a very basic statement concise definition, and here it is. The moral relativism is the view that says this. It says there are no objectively true moral values which apply to all people consistently. Let me say that again. It says there are no objectively true moral values which apply to all people consistently across the board. See what I'm saying? That's what moral relativism is. It's a view that says there aren't any of those things. I'm going to say one more time. There are no objectively true moral values which apply across the board to all people consistently. Now, of course, when you look at that definition, think of that definition, what's the most important word in there, the key word we need to get figured out? The word objective, right? So what's it mean for something to be objective? Well, I think the best way to go about this is to take the opposite word. And so what's the opposite of objective?
Subjective.
Subjective. Let's think about that word for a moment, because here's where we have to get really clear. Is there such a thing as a subjectively true statement? Can you imagine a statement like that? A subjectively true statement? Let me give you one. Any of you a statement which is subjectively true? It's not very profound, but I believe it's subjectively true. The statement is this: ice cream is good. How's that? Now, I said not too profound, but actually it does have some meaning to it. How about this one? Spinach is bad. Now, are those statements true? Well, tell me this. When I make a statement like that, when I say ice cream is bad, what am I really saying? Tell me what that statement really could be translated as. When I, Paul Chamberlain, say ice cream is good, I am saying what?
You like ice cream.
I like ice cream. That's really all I'm saying, isn't it? When I say spinach is bad, what am I saying?
I don't
like spinach. Now, actually, in some salads, it's not too bad. You've got to be pretty careful with it, as far as I'm concerned. It's supposedly good for you. And I grew up thinking it'd make you strong. I've told that many, many times. But when it comes to enjoying it, no. I would say ice cream is good, spinach is bad. So you know what those statements mean? Like we said, I like ice cream, I don't like spinach. What's the deal with these? The deal with these statements is this. When it comes to a subjectively true statement, the truth depends upon what? The attitude or the opinion or the belief of the speaking subject. That's why we call it subjective. Is that not correct? The truth of that statement depends upon my attitude, my opinion, my belief. So put it this way. If I do like ice cream and I say I like ice cream, that statement's true, isn't it? If I like ice cream and I say ice cream is good, that statement's true. It's subjectively true. But you know, but think about it this way. It means this. It means that the subject, the person who made the statement, is the one who, catch these key words, is the one who creates or determines the truth of those statements. Is that not correct? It's the person, themselves, who creates or determines the truth of those statements. So those statements are true because I actually really believe them. That's what makes them true. Okay, if I didn't believe them, they wouldn't be true. So the truth of the statement is created and determined by the speaking subject. But guess what that also means? That means that conflicting subjective statements can both be true. So, your name is again?
Julie.
Julie?
Yeah.
Okay, I almost said Judy. That would be a bad mistake, wouldn't it? Okay, Julie is what? Julie is in the session we just came from, so I feel like I kind of know you a little bit now, don't I? Okay. So let me just say this to Julie. Suppose I talk to Julie and Julie says, actually, I don't like ice cream very much. Now, you wouldn't say that, would you?
I would, actually.
You would. I can hardly believe it. But anyway, there's someone here who actually, it's going to work perfectly for our illustration here, by the way.
Excellent.
Okay. So I'm saying, I make the statement, I put it up on the board, ice cream is good. Julie comes up and says, ice cream is bad. Can those statements both be true?
Yes.
It's kind of a weird thing, but yeah, they can. They looked at their conflicting statements, and they really are. I mean, if they look like it on the board, they look like conflicting statements. How can they both be true? Well, because of the truth of my statements is determined by and created by me. The truth of hers is created and determined by her. Okay, they're subjectively true statements. That's the way subjectively statements are. Now, I want to get back to the, remember the definition of moral relativism? It says, it's the view that says there are no objectively true moral principles out there. Everything's subjective. So what does it mean when we talk about objective statements? Well, let's switch over here and switch from subjective to objective for a few minutes here. Let me give you an example of an objectively true statement. I don't know how many are in there. Are there 30 of us in this room? I don't know what there are, 30, 32. There will be an exact number because that's the number of chairs here. Well, I'm going to go with 32. Let's say there are. So I come in the room and I say, there are 32 people in this room. Now, is that statement true?
Yes.
Yeah. And is it dependent upon my attitude, my belief? No. What if is it Judd? Judd comes in and says, you know what, Chamberlain? In my view, there's 320 people in this room. And we're in Canada, and you need to respect my opinion. Okay? What am I going to say? Well, I guess I can respect your right to hold your opinion, Judd. I could really go all the way and be a great Canadian and do that, okay? But could I ever say, okay, well, Judd's right too? No, I couldn't say that because, you know what, that's not correct, is it? There are 320 here as an objective fact, and guess what? I don't create it, do I? I don't determine it. Guess what I do? I recognize it. Catch that word, get difference in word? That's a really key. So objective truths are there to be recognized or discovered, not determined or created by the subject. They're there to be recognized or discovered. Or so if I say the city of Abbotsford exists. There again, that's an objectively true statement, isn't it? Someone wants to come along and disagree with that, you can disagree. But in that case, at some point, we're going to have to be saying, you know, the fact is you're wrong. Because there is a city of Abbotsford here. Because here's the thing about objective truth. It really is a very stubborn thing. It just sits there to be discovered, to be recognized, not to be created, determined. That's what it means to be objective. Now, let's get back to the point here. Remember moral relativism? It says it's the view that says there are no objectively true moral principles that apply to all people consistently. There just aren't any. Morality, in other words, is all relative to an individual person or situation or time. Morality is a personal, private, subjective matter. So morality is a little bit like the ice cream. It's a little bit like the spinach. It's not like the people in the room or not like the city of Abbotsford which exists. It's in this category, not this category here. And it seems to me when we understand that's how many people are thinking of morality, a lot of the stuff people say actually makes sense. We at least understand what they're saying. Because they're treating morality as though it's in this category over here. I heard an illustration on this a number of years ago from a book. The title of the book was, I read it in a book, it's called Truth is Stranger Than It Used to Be. Okay? Name of the book. And they put this illustration of three umpires standing around together talking about how they do their job. Has anybody here had the dubious privilege of being an umpire before? Baseball umpire? Nobody in the room has done that?
Not on a permanent basis.
No, off and on. Exactly, that's where I had to do it too. Did you like it as much as I liked it?
No.
I know.
Like it at all.
No, well then you did like it as much as I liked it. Because that's how much I liked it too. I never really enjoyed it very much. But I did find out that umpires were paid to be right. And if you waffle even for a second, you're in trouble. Even if you think you're wrong, you still got to act as though you're right. I mean, it's quite a job. And sometimes I think that's what those guys out there are doing too, even when the major leagues. But three umpires standing there together talking about how they do their job. And the first guy said this. Think about the different perspectives. First guy said, here's how I do it. I call them as I see them. Okay? Okay with that? Second one says, no, that's not how I do it. I call them as they are. He's a little more sure of himself, isn't he? I call them as they are. You know what the third guy said? I don't do it either way, either you guys do it. They ain't nothing till I call them. Okay? Think about that. They ain't nothing until I call them. So what's he saying here? He's saying, I don't recognize that pitch as being a ball or a strike or anything on its own, intrinsically, inherently. It ain't nothing until I call it. I determine what it's going to be. My call makes it what it is. That's what he's saying. And I guess what I'd say here is that very, and that's what they were illustrating in the book there, that very same thinking, which when you apply it to morality, gives us moral relativism. The act is not intrinsically good or bad, right or wrong in and of itself. It's my attitude, my perspective on it, my opinion that makes it what it is. So I don't recognize any act as being intrinsically good or bad or right or wrong, whether it be abortion or premarital sex or honesty or fraud or extramarital sex, or it doesn't matter. These may be wrong for you, but let's respect each other. Let's realize, let's not call each other wrong, because in reality, remember on the board here, neither of us is wrong. That's the thing. They go up to the board, we put two different moral positions up there, they're conflicting, and neither is wrong. We're both right, because the truth of our moral statements depends upon, is determined, created by the individual subject or person. You see where we're going here? See how that works? It's really critical for us to get that clear. So you can have your moral attitude, you can have your opinion, I can have mine, and we can both be right. Okay? That's the whole idea of it. And of course, a couple implications coming from that. Number one is we have no right to impose our moral values on others. Can you imagine me coming to send someone like Julie and Julie says, oh, I actually don't care for ice cream. I say, Julie, you've got to. That's completely wrong. And I do everything I can. I badger and say, you've got to like ice cream. You do like it. You just don't know you do. And I go on and on like this. You'd say, Chamberlain, lighten up. Get out of here. She has a right not to like ice cream. She's just as right as you. That's what you'd be saying, right? Well, that's what we're saying with morality. When you move morality over to that category over here, the subjective category, and of course we have no right to impose our moral values on us. So when you hear people in our society talking about the right, no right to impose, that's what they're getting at. They believe it as deeply and strongly as you believe we have no right to impose our personal inclinations on taste onto somebody else. The other is this, of course, the other implication, conflicting moral statements can both be right. That seems odd at first until you understand once it's into the subjective category, well, they can be. If morality is all over there, well, then that's where they can both be right. Now, of course, here's where some confusion comes in, some chaos. As I mentioned a little bit ago, I said they talked about some confusion. Because in our culture today, we have a huge number of people out there claiming to be moral relativists. Now, what I find odd about this is I don't find too many people teaching philosophy who claim to be moral relativists. You can have a debate at a university. I remember one of the first debates I ever had on this issue up at UBC with an atheist professor there, and we called the debate, Can We Be Good Without God? So we called the debate. And asked two questions. Is there such a thing as real objective moral truth? And secondly, if assuming there is God required for it? We both agreed right up front on the first one. The atheist prof just knew just as well as I did that it's a dead-end road to say that everything is self-refuting, actually, in the end, to think that morality is all relative. But many people in the audience were wondering, well, where's our champion? Who's the person promoting moral relativism here? Because it does seem to be a fashionable idea in our culture as a whole. I don't find too many people teaching philosophy holding it, but let's just say this. In our culture, many, many people would claim to be moral relativists in some form, even though maybe inconsistently at times. And denying the existence of objective moral value and not wanting to impose moral values on you and you on them and things like that. That's a way to be tolerant. It's a way to be open and things like that. And because you don't want to be one of those narrow-minded, intolerant bigots imposing your moral values on others. On the other hand, here's the thing, I say confusion. Many of those very same people, have you noticed this, are very willing to roundly condemn the things which they oppose. And in fact, to demonstrate moral outrage at them. Things like intolerance. How about that? We're going to come back to that one again. Because that's probably number one. That's probably the biggest one. But how about this? Bigotry, racism, child abuse, violation of the rights of gays, gay people, violation of the rights of workers in sweatshops. And it goes on. How about this? The practice of killing a woman because she's been raped. Well, we're really quick to condemn that. When they do that in some other country, we are all over that one. Gay bashing, child sacrifice, we hear about it, environmental destruction, rape, slavery, all these things. We condemn these like that in our culture. But this is the same group of people who would want to claim to be moral relativists on the other ground. That's why I say there's some confusion here, because here's the deal. You have no right to condemn any of those things. Intolerance, bigotry, child abuse, rape, slavery, gay bashing, anything. if they're not objectively wrong. You see what I mean? Because if morality is purely subjective and personal and private, then the most you can say is this. The most you could say is to look across at that other practice and say, boy, does that ever offend my moral taste, my personal moral taste. That offends my personal moral taste. I just don't like that. But I guess I have to admit, others obviously have different moral tastes, and they're equally entitled to call those legitimate and good, and I've gotten the right to impose my moral taste on them. That's all you can say if you're a consistent moral relativist. And that's where I see the confusion coming up here. So it becomes quite clear, in our culture at least, that even though the many people will claim to be a relativist and actually practice it at some level, there aren't too many, I think, who are consistent moral relativists because of what it would require. Now, let's do a quick analysis here. I know I see our time is going by. I just want to do a quick analysis. I want to mention 6 points here. The first few are more important. But how do we analyze this? Okay. Well, what do we think about it? Well, I would tell you this. Once we look at the consequences of embracing moral relativism, we will see that for most of us, we're going to have to admit this is doomed. Okay? It is doomed, and thankfully so. But why do we say that? Well, the first one's kind of business we've kind of gone over already, but the first is this. If morality is completely subjective and relative, okay, then first consequence is this, that no act at all could be condemned as genuinely wrong. Okay, you see what I'm saying? We've kind of already said it, but I want to make sure we highlight that one. That's the first point on the notes if you have that there. And it wouldn't matter whether it be intolerance, whether it be murder, whether it be discrimination. Like I say, burning, how about this, burning a woman at her husband's funeral? That used to be practiced in India for years and years until the British put a stop to it. A man would die, husband, and then the wife would be burned at the funeral as well. And the British came in and put a stop to that. And we would say they did a good thing to do that, because that's wrong to do that. Okay? But if morality is completely subjective and relative, then we are not in a position to condemn it as really wrong. The most we can say is it's a matter of personal, private moral taste. And the most we can say is that these things offend my personal moral taste. I don't like them. But others obviously have different moral tastes, and they're equally entitled to call those actions good if they agree with their personal moral taste, which obviously they did in certain places. See, here's the problem. The problem is this, and here's what I would pass on to our young people, that our actions and reactions to it, whether it be to acts of brutality or fraud or dishonesty or unfairness or whatever it may be, betray the fact that all of us, deep down, we do recognize the difference between moral good and evil. We know there is a difference. It's not just that we prefer one over the other, it's that we should prefer. And something's wrong with people who don't prefer one over the other, or they get it backwards. And in fact, it seems to me, we recognize this so strongly that we have terms for people who don't seem to. What do we call them? You ever heard the term psychopath, sociopath? We have these terms. What are we referring to? We're referring to people who don't seem to have any moral categories. They just don't think in terms of morality in any way at all. And we say this is something quite wrong. Something's not right. Now, there's another term out there too. Not quite as technical a term, but we'll use this term. The term scum. That person's scum. What do we mean by scum? It seems to me we recognize, as I listen to the term the occasional time I hear it, it's a different term. It seems to say that that person does recognize the wrongness of the action, but just does it anyway. We call that person scum, okay? But when a person really doesn't seem to recognize it, we say there is something wrong with that person, because deep down we do recognize the difference. Let me draw your attention to something that, when it happened, a number of years back in Canada now, but it just got my attention so much I still think it's worth highlighting here today. And it has to do with a public reaction, which I find really highly instructive. You, anybody remember the name Paul Bernardo? Mm-hmm. Carla Homolka? Mm-hmm. These two out in Ontario, this husband and wife, who kidnapped and killed at least two young women, Leslie Mahaffey, Kristen French were their names, but maybe others as well. And they videotaped the whole thing, and it was a heinous crime. And when they committed these crimes in Canada, there was huge outrage, huge anger expressed both of them. In fact, they had to have heavy police protection when they were being transferred from one place to another. And there was also graffiti sprayed in various places out in Ontario, maybe here too, but on Ontario. And one piece I heard about said this, on a wall in Ontario: "Burn in hell, Bernardo." Vernon Hill, Bernard. Now, you know for a fact that the person who wrote that spoke for a lot of other people. And I looked at that and I thought, that tells us a number of things. That piece of graffiti, if the person who wrote that meant that, you know what that tells us? It tells us at least, number one, that deep down there's an innate awareness that good and evil exist and that this deed that they did was evil. Otherwise, you wouldn't be putting something like that up on the wall. It also seems to tell me that deep down there's an innate awareness that justice should be done. And of course, this person left it no doubt as to what he thought would be just for Bernardo. But that led me into a third one. In our culture, think about this. Does it not tell us that deep down there might even be an innate hope that something like hell does exist for people who we think are bad enough that they really deserve to go there? How about that? How often have you heard hell raised, the existence of hell, as an objection to Christianity? But yet I really wonder how deep that objection really is once we meet someone who we really think ought to go there. Okay, like a Paul Bernardo. Because and it just shows you that that's how strongly we recognize the difference between people like that, between Mother Teresa, let's say, on one hand, and Adolf Hitler. That's number one. If moral relativism is correct, no act could be condemned. Let me flip that around though for number two. And this is one that you maybe have not thought of. If moral relativism is correct, it's also true that no act could actually be commended as genuinely good. How about that? If objective good and evil are gone, well then, they're gone. Okay, it's not just that some things are evil, some things are good as well, but they're gone as well. And it's not that something, it just means now that there's certain things that maybe appeal. It's not that this is good, it just happens to appeal to your personal moral taste, so therefore you like it. But do we actually commend people just for doing things that happen to appeal to their moral taste? So where do we get off commending somebody for having done something good? All they did is do something that happened to appeal to their own personal moral taste. It's hard to see how not just condemnation is available to us anymore for things that are wrong, but even commendation for good acts. Let me go to the third one, which I'm calling blue folders here. This is the third one, which I find quite instructive. The third point by way of analysis is this. It seems to me that even those who claim to be moral relativists rarely succeed in living that way. Okay, as we've kind of commented on already. Now, of course, I've thought quite a bit about that. What does that prove? That doesn't necessarily prove all by itself that moral relativism is false. But if I'm right about saying this, you know what it does kind of mean? It means that it leaves you hanging here and you say, well, if the people who actually do advocate it themselves don't end up believing it very strongly, and it leaves not much room for the reason for the rest of us who didn't believe it in the first place as to why we should adopt it. Well, what are we getting at here? Well, there's a story that's been told. It's been told quite often. Maybe some of you have heard it, and I think it's a true story about a student who wrote an essay for a philosophy class in which he argued quite eloquently for moral relativism. And it was a pretty good essay in terms of its organization, its clarity, its structure, its research, grammar, argumentation, all the things you're looking for in an essay. And the student handed it in a blue folder. Professor read it over, looked at it, and said, I'm going to see if I can just kind of make a point here. And he wrote on the essay at the very end, great essay. However, I'm sorry, I do not like blue folders. Grade F. Okay? And send it back. Okay? Now, if you're a professor and you're ever trying to get a hold of your students, that's a good way to do it. Okay? It's notoriously difficult to try and get a hold of students. You would think it'd be easy, but you just live with it all the time. Well, this is a good way to do it. And the student stormed back into the professor's office and said, you can't do this. That's not fair. That is not just. That is not right. If I wrote a good essay, then I deserve a good grade. So the professor said this, well, listen, is this the essay which argued there are no objective standards which apply consistently, such as fairness and justice? And the student said, yes, that's the one. The prof said, well, then, I do not like blue folders. I'm sorry, your grade's an F. Okay? And as the story goes, when the prof made the point, he changed the grade. But what was the point? The point was this. On the student's own ethical system, the one he argued so passionately for in his essay, and did a good job of it too, by the way, but on his ethical system, he had no legitimate complaint, did he? Because the prof was merely acting as though there were no objective standards of fairness and justice, which applied consistently, just as the student had argued. In other words, he decided to try out the young man's ethical system on the young man himself. And lo and behold, when it came to the student's own essay, what did the student do? He immediately appealed to objective standards of fairness and justice. And get this, he demanded that the professor recognize those and apply those to his own essay. Now, that's really, in my mind, a pretty damning charge, because it shows that moral relativism is probably unlivable, maybe completely untenable. And it shows that none of us gets by very long without appealing to objective moral standards. Here's what I was going to say. I'm just watching the clock here. We have a couple more minutes to go here. But Rabbi Zacharias tells an interesting story about this, of having given a lecture at Oxford University in which he argued against moral relativism. A student came up to him at the end. And he said, I do not believe in objective moral truth, moral value. I'm a relativist. And Rabbi said, I talked to him. I talked to him for 10, 15 minutes. And I tried every which way to convince him that relativism was dead in the water and that there was such a thing as objective moral value. There's nothing I could do. He says, I finally said this to the young man after I gave up with any arguments. I said, let me ask you this one question. Let's suppose I brought a baby up here right now, put that baby down on the podium right in front of us right here, and I grabbed a machete, and I just began hacking that baby into small pieces. I wound up and I just smashed it right down on one part of the baby, another part, all the way through, small little pieces. Would I have done something wrong? Really, really, really wrong, he said. Would I have done something really wrong? And he said, the young man stood there, kind of played with his toes, Rabbi says, because he was wearing sandals, okay? Remember that little detail? Finally he said this, I would not like what you have done, and I'm quoting, I would not like what you have done, but I would not be able to say that what you had done was wrong. Now, all I could say is this, that's the thing about moral relativism. There is not a slam dunk argument against it in the way that there are against certain other systems of thought. What there is a way to bring out the consequences, because in my mind, that's what it'll do for you. It'll force you to having to make these implausible kinds of statements. If that person really means that, if he really truly means that, which I doubt, by the way, but if he really, really, truly means that, then we have a person who's kind of a dangerous person. That person is not willing to call anything wrong, even to that level. And I would like to ask him, what do you think then of what happened in Rwanda? Those 800,000 people who were hacked and macheted and shot and clubbed to death, you think that's okay? I mean, we've all apologized for not stepping in. The U.S. apologized. We apologized for not stepping in when we could have easily stepped in and stopped it. Did we not need to apologize? Did they not do anything wrong over there? What do you really think about that? Okay? That's what you'd have to ask, and I guess that's the point I want to get here, is that moral relativism will push you to the point where you'll end up making highly implausible statements like that one. Let me go to one more point here, and we'll see how our time goes, and that is this. How about this? We mentioned tolerance a number of times. The point I want to make here is that very commonly there will be an appeal to tolerance as the reason why we need to be moral relativists. We need to be tolerant. Now, tolerance is something, by the way, I advocate. We have to define it very carefully. It's often defined in a way that I think is kind of confused in our culture. But once we get the definition careful, it seems to me it's a critically important quality and a value that we ought to uphold. But here's the interesting thing. What if you appeal to tolerance as a reason or as a basis for thinking we need to be moral relativists? Because if we're objective, we hold to objective moral value, we're going to be saying things like, well, my position's right, and your position, if you disagree with me, is wrong, and that's just so intolerant. And we're supposed to be tolerant, so in order to be tolerant, we need to be moral relativists. How about that? There's two things going on there. Number one is there's a definition of tolerance that we really need to clarify, which is another lecture, I guess, but it really is important. But the second one is this, and the point I want to make here today. Appealing to tolerance as the basis or reason for preferring moral relativism is counterproductive. In fact, it is self-refuting. Why would I say that? Very simple reason why I say that. Because you know what it does? When you do that, what have you just done with tolerance? You treated tolerance as a bedrock objective moral principle. That's what you've just done. Right? You've just done it. That's why it's important to be moral, because we have to be tolerant. Intolerance is a great evil. It's a great wrong. Therefore, we need to be moral relativists. You've just appealed to tolerance as a bedrock objective moral value. That's your moral system. It builds on one idea, tolerance. Which I don't think is that far off from a lot of the way that many Canadians actually do ethics today. Starts with tolerance and kind of works out from there, defined a certain way. But if you've done that, then you appeal to tolerance as the reason for preferring moral relativism. It just backfired on you. It's counterproductive and self-refuting because you have now ended up treating tolerance as a bedrock objective moral principle. You see what I'm saying? Which, in my mind, you should. It just means you can't then move from there to moral relativism. You should realize I'm an objectivist as well. And one of my fundamental moral principles is tolerance. So now let's get busy and define that word, because that's a really important word. Even God is said to be tolerant. You remember that? Romans 2:4? His tolerance and his kindness or his way, and patience are ways of leading us to repentance. Romans 2:4. That's our English translation, has the word tolerance. And so tolerance is not a bad thing. We're just about done, aren't we, here? Okay. Here I've got the two more points here, and I'm going to skip over those for a moment because they're not the most important, but I just want to say this. What all this means, the implication of all this, is that if relativism fails, it's simply because there really is objective moral truth out there, the kind we recognize, we didn't invent. We discover it, we can't avoid it, we can't deny it, it's all there for us. It's there in the world that God put us in. In other words, morality is not all relative, it's not all a personal, private matter. But what that means is this. That means that then when Scripture, or even other moral codes around the world, when they proclaim objective moral teachings to us, when the Scripture does it, it's making sense. It's agreeing with deep down with what we already know here. Romans chapter 2, it talks about even the Gentile nations having the law of God written in their hearts. Remember that? Even they understand the difference between good and evil because they're made by the same God, the same Creator, but the same moral conscience and the same knowledge of objective good and evil. But here's what that means for us. I think we have a phenomenal privilege here, opportunity for us, and that is to teach our children, to set before our young people, our children, the existence of real good and evil. And I would just make this prediction to you, that when we do that, when we teach them this, that message will resonate with their own God-given moral conscience as well. They will instinctively agree with you because it's there in their minds as well. But they need to hear it from people they trust, parents, grandparents, pastors, teachers, friends they respect, even medical practitioners. They need to hear it from people they trust. And I would say this, if we set it before them, it will help clear up their own confusion in a society that is full of confusion. And that confusion will be fed to them in every which way, all the way through, from the school system, which I have a lot of appreciation for, by the way, but it'll feed the same thing. And just culture in general, it'll feed. So by the time they get to university, the universities won't have to make you relativists, just like we read here. You'll be that already, unless we, as Christian parents and teachers and influencers, have an opportunity to simply set before people what their moral conscience will already affirm, and that is the existence of real objective good and evil. We have maybe 1 minute. Yeah, 1 minute. We got a real hard-nosed guy at the back here. He's pretty much, you can't negotiate with this. I can't negotiate anything with this guy at the back here. You know, one question here, yes.
I was just wondering, how do you answer someone who says, I believe in moral relativism as long as it doesn't infringe on someone else's rights?
You agree with moral relativism or objective, you mean?
No, subjective. So, you know, I go along with that as long as it doesn't interfere with someone else's rights.
Well, what I'm not sure how moral relative position would infringe on somebody else's right, because all you're saying then is this is my view and you would have your view as well, which would be different than mine. I'm not sure how that ever would. I could see how the opposite might be seen to infringe on somebody else's rights. And I guess I'd say that's all part of what we need to be thinking in terms of our moral obligation. Do we have the right to infringe on somebody else's rights? Well, we have laws that tell us how we ought to be functioning, and there are certain basic moral principles. I think we do need to be careful what we label as objectively right and wrong. Be very careful with that, but recognize that there is a bedrock of objectivity there in terms of the moral level. Don't know if I can answer that better than that, but we can talk more. Hey, thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Really great. You have a really good day. Take care, my friend.